I don't know about you, but there are times in my life when I feel a connection with the Lord. I feel a sense of closeness in being with Him. And everything else seems like an interruption. It seems like a distraction. And I truly wonder what it's going to be like when we stand before Him and we see Him as He really is. And there will never again be any distraction, never again be any interruption, never anything that would ever mask the true greatness and glory of God. What that would be like for us. I long for that. I hope you do as well. That we would let go of what this world presents to us all bright and shiny, and we would choose to cling to what we know to be the truth. Let's look into Genesis chapter 20 today. We've looked at the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, the Dead Sea cities. That judgment has been completed and pronounced. We know that Lot's wife was a casualty of that, as was all living things within the Dead Sea cities. Lot has fled to Zoar, and then off to the mountains with his two daughters. And while in the cave, living apart from other civilization, the daughters concocted this sinful plan to have children with their father and to prolong the family name, the family line. And so Lot becomes the father of Moab and then Ben-Ami. And so as we turn the page from what took place in chapters 18 and 19, we look at chapter 20. And here we find Abraham resorting back to an earlier pattern of fear, of a lack of faith in God, his primary concern of self-preservation as he presents his wife Sarah as his sister. And again, Sarah is taken into a king's harem. Now, this sounds very familiar, doesn't it? All the way back in, I think, Genesis 13 or so, we saw the same thing happen when Abraham sojourned down into the Negev to be in the area of Egypt and presented his wife Sarah as his sister, and she was taken into Pharaoh's household. Well, this is not a regurgitation of that. It's not a retelling of the same event. It's similar in some ways, but it is also very different. But what stands out to me is we read of another episode where Abraham journeys into an area he's unfamiliar with and presents his wife as a sister. We see this pattern within Abraham's life even after all of these first-hand experiences that he's had with the Lord. The visions, the appearances, the ratification of the covenant where God appeared as a smoking pot and a flaming fire and went between the severed animals to communicate his commitment to this plan. All that Abraham has experienced, all of these things he's experienced firsthand for himself, cannot reverse this sinful tendency he has. Even after 25 years of walking with the Lord and seeing all that the Lord had already accomplished in his life, thinking about what had just taken place back in chapters 18 with an appearance of God and the two heavenly beings who recommunicate the promise of a son from Sarah, the promised son who would be Isaac in just 1 year's time, we very quickly find Abraham reverting back to this lack of faith, this concern over self-preservation, and now presenting his wife Sarah as a sister again and risking the promise of this heir that was going to come to him. As we go back to the beginning of our encounter with Abraham, when he was first called out of Ur of the Chaldeans and came into this unknown land with this unknown people and went into Egypt, it was somewhat defensible to see Abraham resort to this episode of fear and self-preservation. But now 25 years later, he's going back to that default mode and not appropriating what seems to be anything that he has learned in the 25 years that he has walked with God. Additionally, the last time Abraham presented Sarah as his wife Sarah as a sister, we know that Pharaoh took her in. She was there for an unknown amount of time, a part of the harem, taken as a wife. This time, on the heels of Sarah hearing for her own with her hearing for herself with her own ears the promise of a son in just a year's time. There is this risk that has now come into Sarah's life about the fulfillment of this promised son, because now she's been given over to this second king, presumably to become his wife as well. So we're going to look at chapter 20. We're going to look at this in verses as we go, instead of reading the entirety of the chapter and coming back and looking at each section individually. So we're going to revisit here Abraham's sin. This is his familiar sin, his default position as he's gone into unknown territory again. So reading Genesis 21 to 18. Now Abraham journeyed from there toward the land of the Negev and settled between Kadesh and Shur when he sojourned in Gerar. Abraham said of Sarah his wife, "She is my sister." So Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. So we see here that Abraham travels. Details are non-existent. They're not provided for us as to the motivation for Abraham's travels. We don't know what all was a part of that consideration. It could have been that having looked down upon the destruction of the Dead Sea cities and the smoldering remains rising up to the heavens, that he just needed a change of scenery. We don't really know, but he travels. We can only speculate as to why, but he travels down into the south country, or the country called the Negev, as he had in the past. So the exact location of Gerar is not known, but the general area is. So as we look at this map, we've looked at this several times in our explanation of Genesis. So the area where Abraham is somewhere right in here. We see Jerusalem, and this is Zoar, the Dead Sea cities. You see Philistine here, and somewhere down in this area, the southern border of what would be a part of Canaan, Abraham has now traveled. It's possible he wanted to feed the livestock or just get away from the Dead Sea city reminder, but he's moved into this region again, this area known as a city of the Philistines, this area of Gerar. And after settling there, verse 2 tells us that Abraham declares that Sarah is his sister. We aren't told to whom he makes this declaration or why, but we know somebody has been told. And the end result of this is that King Abimelech comes and takes Sarah, and Sarah again is abducted. Now the name Abimelech may not refer to a specific king, but many believe that it's just a general title for king, much like Pharaoh is for the ruler of Egypt, or Caesar would be for those that rule over Rome. But nonetheless, King Abimelech comes and takes Sarah into his harem, and she is now going to be his wife. So the prior Egyptian incident credits Sarah's great beauty for her abduction. This is all the way back in Genesis chapter 12. But as we follow the story of Abraham chronologically, Sarah is now 90. It would no longer be the same attractive woman that she was some 25 years earlier. And so it's possible that there's another consideration here that was a part of the king's motivation for taking her as his wife. We don't really know, but a possible explanation could be that the desire to forge some kind of an economic relationship with Abraham. After all, Abraham was vastly wealthy, had a huge amount of livestock, had a number of people that were in his charge. We aren't told specifically how many people were a part of Abraham's family. But it wouldn't be implausible for this king to look down on this newcomer in the area to see the size of it and want to forge some kind of a friendship there. And as we would look into chapter 21, it seems to be that that's very possible after there is an agreement made between King Abimelech and Abraham after the birth of Isaac, but we'll get there in just a couple of weeks. So we're not exactly sure why this explanation of taking Sarah into the harem is actually taking place, but it's possible that the king just wanted to take her because this is what kings do. In this culture, kings took women because they could and because they wanted to. But we don't really know. But the details and the motives for her abduction are not central to the story. And we're going to look at this unfold as we go through it. So we see that Sarah is abducted as a part of Abraham's travels. Let her be in the building outline is that God intervenes. And as we begin to look at this, I want to ask you the question, where would mankind be if God did not intervene? Where would you be if God did not intervene? We know that God has intersected our lives through the presentation of this great gift of salvation. But how many other times in our lives has God intervened, perhaps even in ways we don't specifically recognize? Well, God is always working. God is always guiding. God is always doing things in the fulfillment of the plans and purposes that He has for us. And the question for me is, where would we be apart from the intervention of God? Well, the plans and purposes that God has are worked out through the lives of men and women that He has called. The fulfillment of these plans and purposes often require the intervention of God because of the fickle nature of our faith, because of the mistrusting nature of these same men and women who are called in the sovereign God's ability to accomplish these plans, right? So we often think that we have to help God, that God is somehow slack, or that God is somehow slow, or that God is somehow deficient in carrying out these plans and purposes. And so we go to a default position of mistrust, of not really seeing God do what we think He ought to do. But God intervenes because apart from the intervention of God, I'm not sure we could really accomplish very much for Him because of the fickle nature of our faith. So as a part of this intervention, first we see God speaks. Verse 3, but God came to Abimelech in a dream of the night and said to him, behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is married. Now, God knows how to get the attention of someone whom He wants to intervene in the life of. Isn't that right? God appears in this dream and says, behold, you are a dead man. Now, I don't know how much that would capture your attention in a dream. I would imagine we would wake up huffing and puffing and glad that it was just a dream. But in this culture, and even in our own culture today, we believe that the gods, little g God, or perhaps the great big Yahweh God, speaks to us in dreams. Have you ever talked to anybody who said, God spoke to me in a dream, and they believe it with all their hearts? I remember years ago, I had a girl in a part of a Sunday school class that I was teaching, and she said, God spoke to me last night in a dream. It was the wildest thing I'd ever experienced. I could see Jesus at the foot of my bed, and I reached out and touched His arm, and I could feel the hair on His arm. She believed with all her heart that God appeared and God spoke. But this is what people think, most especially in the ancient culture. So God has appeared to Abimelech in a dream and has said, you are a dead man because she is married. Well, unbeknownst to King Abimelech, Sarah is married, and this is a big problem. The Philistine king did not know or worship Yahweh, but undoubtedly, he possessed some kind of religion, as virtually every king did. And this appearance and this warning has certainly caught his attention. He is facing certain and imminent death because of what has transpired in his abduction of Sarah. Number 2, Abimelech defends what has actually taken place. Verses 4 and 5. Now, Abimelech had not come near her, Sarah, and he said, Lord, will you slay a nation, even though blameless? Did he not himself say to me, she is my sister? And she herself said, he is my brother. In the integrity of my heart, in the innocence of my hands, I have not done this. Now, there's not a lot of detail that is given to us here, but it's very reminiscent of what took place when Abraham was in Egypt, and it's very likely that Moses, the author of this, understands that there would be some things supplied here by the reader that would fill out some of the understanding more than what we see in the specifics here. But Abimelech explains himself very simply. She was presented to me as his sister. She told me that he was his brother, and I've not done anything. I haven't touched her. I haven't done anything that I would be guilty of that would deserve death. I'm not guilty of adultery. Now, what may surprise you is this. In most of these ancient cultures, adultery was forbidden. Now, unlike Sodom and Gomorrah, where there was likely no moral virtue of any kind, in most ancient cultures, adultery was forbidden, and the punishment for adultery was death. This is the exact same restriction that eventually became a part of the Mosaic Law some 500 years later, is if you commit adultery, you are going to die. So the king knows this because this is very likely the same code of ethics that they operate under. But the king declares his innocence and calls out to God to not destroy his nation since he is innocent of any wrongdoing. Now, we are also told that the king had not touched Sarah or come near her, and this tells us two things which are not revealed in this passage. The first one is this, and this is very important as we look back on 18 and 19 and as we move forward into 21. The first reason that this is very important is this preserves Sarah's future pregnancy and birth of Isaac in chapter 21 as attributable to Abraham only. Since Abimelech had not touched her or had come near her, the reader cannot think that her pregnancy and the birth of Isaac was the result of her abduction by this king. So it's very important that this is stated because it preserves the fatherhood of Abraham over the promised son, Isaac. Second thing that is not fully revealed in the passage is this. In combination with what is said here, and then in verse 6, and then in verse 17 and 18, something has happened in King Abimelech's house, which is not detailed, it's not explained, and this has prevented him from being able to consummate the relationship with Sarah. So thinking back on what took place when Sarah was abducted by Pharaoh, the house of Pharaoh was afflicted with some kind of skin disease, and everybody but Sarah contracted that skin disease, and it made it clear that there was something that was wrong within Pharaoh's household, and there was an indication that Sarah was the root of this problem. So something similar has happened in King Abimelech's house, which is not explained, and this ailment has prevented him from being able to consummate this relationship with Sarah, and this is why he has said, I have not touched her, nor have I gone near her. So something has happened within the house which has prevented the king from consummating the relationship with Sarah, and after Sarah's release, God restores the ability to have children in the king's house. So this is important because, again, it preserves the fatherhood of Isaac, and it also makes impossible the idea that something could have happened with Sarah after she had been abducted. We'll look at that in a little bit more detail in just a moment. So Abimelech has called out to God of his innocence, and as we continue through this passage, we see number 3, God confirms that the king is actually innocent. Verse 6, then God said to him in the dream, yes, I know that in the integrity of your heart you have done this, and I also kept you from sinning against me, therefore I did not let you touch her. This is important. What I just said, what is being said here, confirms that Abimelech did not go near or touch Sarah. So God agrees with the king's declaration of innocence. He has not committed adultery with Sarah. And it's very important that we do not miss this. God prevented the king from consummation with Sarah It was the work of God that kept this sinful act from happening. It was not the virtuous king that prevented this consummation. It was the sovereign work of God that prevented that situation from taking place. So while the king announces his innocence, it's not that he knew there was something wrong and chose not to do it. He probably wanted to consummate the relationship with Sarah, but was prevented from doing it through the sovereign hand and work of God. So we aren't told how, we aren't told what God did, but many speculated that God rendered the king impotent in order to protect Sarah and the lineage of the promised son, Isaac. As we go through the end of this passage, verse 17 and 18, it appears that it was not just restricted to the king, but something had happened within all of the women that would prevent them from being able to give birth to children. We aren't told what they are, what happened, but God had closed up the womb. It appears that the king is impotent and couldn't do anything with Sarah, even if he wanted to. And so God's sovereign intervention in protecting Sarah and preserving the lineage of Isaac is paramount in what we are to take out of this passage. So if this is accurate, that this is exactly what God has done, he's rendered the king impotent, then God had probably already opened the womb of Sarah, enabling her to conceive Isaac, although she has not yet conceived the son of promise. That's going to come after her release. So Abraham had already fathered Ishmael through the sinful plan of Sarah. And God was not going to allow Sarah's child to be the result of her abduction to King Abimelech, which would be the result of the sinful plan of Abraham. So two sinful plans, one resulting in the birth of Ishmael, the sinful plan of Abraham that could have possibly resulted in the birth of a son, not Isaac, the promised son. And so God intervenes, protects Sarah, and preserves the lineage of Isaac, who would be the promised son that would come from the union of Abraham and Sarah. So the sovereign work of God in promising the son to Abraham and Sarah, and it will be the sovereign work of God in providing the promised son and protecting Abraham and Sarah from themselves. This is what I believe is central to this narrative, is the sovereign work of God in preserving the lineage of Isaac, preserving his plan and his purpose, and the fickle faith, the sinful plans of Isaac and of Sarah. So number four in our outline, God instructs. Still speaking to King Abimelech. Now therefore, verse 7, restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you will live. But if you do not restore her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours. So God gives very specific instructions that King Abimelech is to restore Sarah back to Abraham. If you do not do this, you and in the entirety of your family is going to die. So the options are very, very clear. Restore or die. So we also learn here that God calls Abraham a prophet. And that Abraham is going to pray for the king, his health is going to be restored, and his life is going to be preserved. So by calling Abraham a prophet here, it is very likely that Abraham's notoriety in the region is going to grow. And if King Abimelech actually believes that Abraham is a prophet, it makes sense that what we see take place in chapter 21, when Abraham and King Abimelech come to some kind of a treaty together, that Abimelech probably has some self-preservation as a part of his motivation in making this coalition with Abraham. So this is what takes place in the dream that Abimelech has. God speaks, God warns, God instructs, and now after Abimelech wakes up, the king is going to confront Abraham and what has taken place. So in verse 8, so Abimelech arose early in the morning and called all his servants and told all these things in their hearing, and the men were greatly frightened. So he calls together this council that he has. He relays the content of the dream that he had had, and they are all greatly frightened. When that phrase is used, it means exactly what it sounds like. It's the same phrase that is used in the account of Jonah after he goes below deck and sleeps and the storm comes. All of the men on deck are greatly frightened and they know something's going on. It's the same thing here. Now remember, the Dead Sea cities have just been destroyed. It is unknown how much they knew that this was attributable to the God of Abraham. It's very possible that they knew people who had died in those cities. It's fresh on their minds. And if they knew that Abraham was serving the God who is responsible for this, you can imagine why their fear would be greatly heightened as a result of the dream that the king had. So if Abraham is a prophet of the God that destroyed the Dead Sea cities, we better do exactly what I've been instructed to do. So the king asks Abraham very reasonable questions. What, how, and why? Verse 9 and 10. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, "What have you done to us? And how have I sinned against you that you have brought on me and on my kingdom a great sin? You have done to me things that ought not be done." And Abimelech said to Abraham, "What have you encountered that you have done this thing?" So the king is incensed, and rightfully so. He had not done anything to Abraham and probably didn't know him prior to his arrival in Gerar. And now he is looking at a death sentence. He and his family and his kingdom because of this treachery that has come to him as a result of Abraham's scheme. He simply asks the questions, "What have you done to us? How have I sinned against you? And why would you do such a thing?" As I thought about this, as I was thinking on these questions, it dawned on me that these are the exact same questions that we ask when we are facing what we consider to be unjust consequences. Right? Isn't that exactly what happens? What have I done? How have you come to the conclusion that this is exactly what you need to do? Why are you doing this thing to me? I certainly don't deserve that. This is exactly what I believe we ask ourselves, sometimes even to God Himself, when something very, very difficult comes our way. What have I done? Why are you bringing this to me? I don't see how in the world anything I have done would merit this kind of reaction on your part. Well, what is interesting is that the king's confrontation of Abraham has the tone of a divine reprimand. The questions King Abimelech asks Abraham could very well be the questions that God would ask Abraham if he was having a private audience with him. It is almost as if God is speaking to Abraham through the king and asking Abraham, "What have I, God, done to you that you would do this dreadful thing?" Abraham's answers are far from reasonable, so we look at Abraham's excuses. Verse 11. Abraham said, "Because I thought, surely there is no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife." So Abraham assumed that there was no moral integrity within the city. Well, given the condition of Sodom and Gomorrah and the Dead Sea cities, that might have been a reasonable assumption. The phrase here, fear of God, generally speaks to living by a moral code of ethics. And for kings, it means to rule justly. So Abraham assumed that there is no moral code of ethics here. And even if there is, you, the king, are probably not going to act justly. Therefore, you would kill me so that you could take my wife. This is exactly what Abraham is guilty of. This is what he assumes, that the king would kill him rather than commit adultery and then take for himself his wife. Now, while it might seem like a stretch that a king would actually do such a thing, It isn't long after the establishment of Israel that David would commit adultery with Bathsheba and then would kill Uriah to cover up the pregnancy and his sin and the adulterous relationship. He did this in reverse order. But this was not uncommon in ancient cultures that kings would actually do such a thing, even though there is a moral code of ethic. So kings did not always rule justly, even under the operation of code of ethics. And this is exactly what Abraham is fearful of. And as a part of this, he exhibits absolutely zero faith in God's ability to protect and to provide for he and Sarah as they venture into this new territory. Abraham basically tells the king, I did this because I did not trust you. Abraham could very well say to God, I did this because I had no faith in you. Verse 12, Abraham goes on, besides, she actually is my sister, the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. She became my wife. So it's partially true. Isn't a half-truth true? Isn't it just a little white lie, God, that she is my sister even though she is my wife? And this is exactly how we tend to deal with God when confronted in our sin. Well, you know, it's really not that big of a deal. I know a lot of people who seem to be greatly blessed by you that are doing a lot worse than I am doing. So this is a part of the rationale that I think exists within the hearts of man. Even in this man, this great patriarch of faith, that he justifies and rationalizes his sin by clinging to the loophole, well, she's my half-sister as well as my wife. So, Abraham also goes on to say that this has been our M.O. since we left Ur of the Chaldeans, when God called me to leave my homeland. This is what we decided in advance that we would do. Verse 13, and it came about when God caused me to wander from my father's house that I said to her, Sarah, this is the kindness which you will show to me everywhere we go. Say of me, he is my brother. So they concocted this plan on the heels of having been called out of Ur of the Chaldeans. This was their default position. Anytime they entered into a new area, this is what they did in Egypt. We aren't told if this happened in the land of Canaan. It's what's taking place here in Gerar. And so Abraham's expectation of loyalty from Sarah was that she would simply comply with this plan. And so in self-preservation, Abraham was willing to risk the well-being of his wife and expected her to assume this risk as a sign of loyalty to him. Well, gee, thanks a lot, husband. I guess I don't have any choice. This is what I'm going to do. I will risk my safety as a sign of loyalty to you so that your life can be spared. Doesn't matter what happens to me, right, husband? It's all about preserving you and risking me. This is exactly what Abraham is doing. This is what he planned to do from the very beginning, anytime they entered into the new area and they were confronted with, hey, who is this girl that you got with you? So this plan originated in the heart of Abraham before he knew anything about God. This is his sinful disposition, self-reliance, and self-preservation. Some 25 years later, all of his experiences with God did not change this default disposition of self-preservation and self-reliance. This has manifested itself in the life of Abraham here as a reliance on human wisdom and a lack of faith in God. Whenever we have a position of self-reliance, it depends upon me, not about God. When we have a default position of self-preservation, I'm not going to risk anything that might be harmful to me, it will manifest itself in a lack of faith in God. When God speaks to us through the truth of His Word, and we are convicted to the depth of our core. Our faith is challenged, and we will often say, yeah, but God, that's going to be really, really hard. Yeah, but God, that might bring great risk to me. God, I might actually be injured if I were to do such a thing. And so out of self-preservation and in self-reliance, we will manifest a lack of faith in God. You can mark it down. I believe it's a spiritual truth. Everywhere we see a lack of faith expressed in God, I believe at its heart, it's self-preservation and self-reliance. So as we look at this great patriarch in the faith, and all that God had done, and all that God had revealed, and all the times God has spoken to him, it would be very easy for us to say, that Abraham, that little scoundrel of a dog. But it's exactly where we live today. We have a completed revelation. There aren't really any blanks. And what God has called, what God has instructed, what God has made available, there's some details that we don't have, but we know the gist, right? God will always be with us. God has called us to serve Him. God will be with us every step of the way. But, and that's the way it goes. Complete a revelation of God, all of our past experiences with God, all the many, many times we've seen the faithfulness of God, we still lack faith. We express our faith in God, but at the same time, we're often crippled by fear and default back to our position of sinful, default back to our sinful disposition of self-reliance and self-preservation. This is exactly what Abraham has done. And with all that we've read and studied about Abraham, we couldn't imagine why he would do such a thing. But we are not that different from him. So as we go through this, we see letter D, the king restores, verses 14 through 16. Abimelech then took sheep and oxen and male and female servants and gave them to Abraham and restored his wife Sarah to him. Abimelech said, behold, my land is before you. Settle wherever you please. To Sarah, he said, behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, it is your vindication before all who are with you, and before all men you are cleared. So just like in Egypt, Abraham has paid reparations for Sarah's treatment, even though Abraham was the cause for the mistreatment. Now, this is an absolution of Abraham's sin. It is very simply God's graciousness expressed even through the sinful plans of Abraham. Abraham is given livestock and servants and 1,000 pieces of silver as a means of this reparation. And unlike Pharaoh, who expelled Abraham from the land, King Abimelech invites Abraham to graze in the land. It's all before you. Go wherever you'd like. I'm not going to come after you. You have no threat from me. Go and enjoy the rich pasture lands for your livestock. Abimelech is interested in creating a friendly relationship with God, potentially because he knows he's a prophet of God, and we're going to see that come to fruition in chapter 21 when they do make this coalition together. So whether he's wanting to make this friendly relationship with God or is fearful of the God who has threatened to kill him, Abraham is free to graze in the land. The king has no problem with that. Verse 16, is important because it clears Sarah of all wrongdoing, and it affirms that she is not an adulteress since she has been cleared before all men. Again, that becomes a segue into the birth of Isaac that we're going to look at here in chapter 21. So the dreadful narrative that we see here ends in letter E, God restores, verse 17 and 18. Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and his maids so that they bore children, for the Lord had closed fast all the wombs of the household of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. So again, we're not told what Abimelech was stricken with, but Abraham prays for him, his health is restored, his life is now going to be preserved. Additionally, God opens the wombs so that the king's family will again be able to have children. And so as we think about this narrative, it's not about the details of the abduction that we can't really explain or understand. It's about fear and faith always being enemies of one another. It's about self-reliance and faith in God being enemies of one another. It's about God's intervention in the lives of His people when they exhibit this lack of faith, and when it is that they default back to this position of self-preservation and self-reliance. This is what it's about: God preserving His promises through feeble men by means that can only be explained by Him. It is a lesson that Abraham, like us, had a very difficult time in learning. But eventually we're going to see the epitome of that, of the depth of his faith, when after the coming of the promised son, Abraham is willing to march up Mount Moriah, thinking that he's going to be called to sacrifice his one and only son. So this challenge of fear and faith, of self-reliance and faith in God, is always a challenge for us to learn. And we ought to pray that God would reveal that to us in the little things and in the big things, because whenever we express a lack of faith and whenever we are relying on human wisdom, which is rooted in our own sense of self-preservation, it's always going to be a barrier to spiritual progress. If we want to see God do that which can only be explained by Him, we have to let go of human wisdom. We have to express faith and die to ourselves, not worry about what might happen to me, and just believe in this great God who has loved and saved and restored and promised and shown Himself to be faithful to us time after time after time. Let's pray together.